On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Texas Congressman and maverick GOP presidential contender Ron Paul is the debate stage wild card in the Republican push for the presidency. In debate, after McCain and Giuliani and Romney and the rest have had their mainline say, Ron Paul turns over the tables. He trembles with passion as he says the GOP has lost its way, above all in Iraq. Bushbackers hate him, disillusioned Republicans, and many others have made him a cult hero, and maybe more than that. Joining me now from Washington is Congressman Ron Paul. He's a doctor, an OBGYN, who, after 4,000 deliveries, still takes time out of his political career to deliver the occasional baby. He's represented Texas's 14th district for a total of 10 terms, going all the way back to 1976. He ran for president in 1988 as the Libertarian Party's candidate. He serves on the House of Representatives International Relations, Financial Services, and Joint Economic Committees, and he's running for president in the 2008 election. Congressman Ron Paul, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's real nice to be with you.
Why are you in this race, to win or to make a point?
Well, I don't think anybody ever enters a race without the intent to win. So that is the goal, and that's the purpose of political action. But hopefully I want to make a point. Also, I don't want to win without people understanding exactly what I believe in. I want the message to win as much as I personally want to win. So I think it's a combination. But, you know, early on in my career when I first ran for Congress, I really didn't expect a whole lot. But I did run, and I surprised myself and others that I did win. So I think you have to set that as a goal.
What do you make of the fact that though you're nowhere in the general poll, on the internet, you're a star. You've got people and bloggers and numbers all over the place on the web, sort of floating Ron Paul up to the heavens. Is this cult hero worship? What's going on there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope it's not a cult. I hope it's philosophic, and I'm delighted that young people are attracted to these ideas that I've been presenting. But, you know, the polls may be accurate. They may not be, but there are certain things that we have to consider. The fact that the people who support me don't have many telephones in their house, so they never get called. They all have their cell phones.
Right.
And therefore, it's not a true reflection. And I think only time will tell about how effective the campaign will be and how much the internet plays a role. Every year it plays a greater role. And this year, I think it's significantly higher than even the last presidential race. And that to me is very good because I think in many ways, excuse me, the internet is a real political equalizer.
Congressman, I want to get your take on what's going on in the high or low theater of these Republican debates. I'm not sure quite how to characterize it. Many Republicans, or at least some very vociferous ones, want you off the debate stage. Listen with us, if you would, and then interpret to a little more of your famous or infamous comments on the 9/11 attacks from the second Republican debate here, May 15th, Columbia, South Carolina.
Are you suggesting we invited the 9/11 attacks, sir?
I'm suggesting that we listen to the people who attacked us and the reason they did it. And they are delighted that we're over there because Osama bin Laden has said, I am glad you're over on our sand because we can target you so much easier. They've already now, since that time, have killed 3,400 of our men, and I don't think it was necessary.
Wendell, may I make a comment on that? That's really an extraordinary statement. That's an extraordinary statement as someone who lived through the attack of September 11. That we invited the attack because we were attacking Iraq. I don't think I've ever heard that before, and I've heard some pretty absurd explanations for September 11.
Okay, there was Rudy Giuliani coming in very hard on you, Congressman. He pressed on, but you responded with another salvo of unconventional wisdom.
And I would ask the congressman to withdraw that comment and tell us that he didn't really mean that.
Congressman?
I believe very sincerely that the CIA is correct when they teach and talk about blowback. When we went into Iran in 1953 and installed the Shah, yes, there was blowback. The reaction to that was the taking of our hostages, and that persists. And if we ignore that, we ignore that at our own risk. That if we think that we can do what we want around the world and not incite hatred, then we have a problem. They don't come here to attack us because we're rich and we're free. They come and they attack us because we're over there. I mean, what would we think if we were if other foreign countries were doing that to us?
Can I have 30 seconds, please?
No, wait a second. Let's all get 30 seconds.
They are coming.
South Carolina, May 15th. Congressman, you were there right in the thick of it. Rudy Giuliani coming back like gangbusters and Mitt Romney trying to get in there on the end. Huge applause in that hall for Giuliani when he attacked your position. How do you interpret that applause in that hall with that Republican crowd that night, Congressman Ron Paul?
Well, it's an obvious reflection of the type of crowd there. They have accepted the conventional, or at least the current, political wisdom of the leadership of the Republican Party, that we are now a war party, that we are the warmongers, and we no longer are the party that would come and clean up the mess caused by the other party, such as when we got involved in Korea and Vietnam. The Republicans were called to try to end those wars, and yet now we're the ones that accept and even promote the idea of preemptive war. So they're reflecting that, and I have to admit it was a rather lonely moment up there on that stage, and especially with that crowd, thinking that I'm the only one on earth that might be thinking along these lines. But the truth is I was able to back up everything I said by a lot of people a lot smarter than I am, people who have researched and had a lot more experience, such as CIA agents and many historians and analysts and political scientists who say this is absolutely true. So when, although I thought it was a very bad moment, it probably didn't take 30 minutes for me to realize that most of the country was with me and not with the demagoguery of Giuliani.
But on that stage, in that hall, as you say, you looked and sounded pretty alone. What do you make of that? You've been in the GOP for a long time, though you've fallen out to be straight-up libertarian for a while. But what do you make of the place that the Republican Party has come on the use of the American military and war today? Why were you so alone in that hall?
Well, it's a good question, but we certainly have been drifting in that direction for a good while. I did not, I got back into politics after having been out for 12 years after the Republicans won in 1994, thinking, well, they're serious. If you listen to the rhetoric of the Republican Party, they're for small government. And those of us who believe in the Constitution want small government because that's what it mandates. And so I ran in 96 and won, but by the time I got into Congress in 97, I was pretty disappointed that we weren't really going to move in that direction. But then again, the year 2000, I thought, well, maybe a Republican president who ran on the program of no nation building and no policeman of the world, and that we should have a humble foreign policy, I considered that a pretty important statement. So I thought, well, maybe we'll move in that direction. But then it didn't take long. Matter of fact, Paul O'Neill didn't take but his first meeting, first cabinet meeting, when they talked about, well, when are we going to hit Iraq. That was a long time before 9/11. So they had a plan and an intent to go over there a long time before. But quite frankly, it's not by one party. The leadership in both parties endorse our foreign policy in the Middle East. So it may be that I feel alone when I'm in certain groups like that. But if you look at the people in the country, I mean, the polls are with me, not me personally, but with my positions of being opposed to this war. 70% of the people in this country want to end this war. So I would say that the Republican Party is out of step. And I, quite frankly, cannot see how the Republican Party can win without a candidate next year that demands and insists on a change in our foreign policy, in particular in Iraq.
Big calls from prominent Republicans after some of these debates to get you off that stage in the future and out of the debate arena. Some movement in that direction already in Iowa that we're hearing about. Do you think you're going to last up there? Are you going to be booted off the stage? Do you have Republican powerhouses on the phone saying, Ron, shut up, you're really giving us problems?
You know, it's a good question. They may well do it. They're certainly trying to do that with a forum in Iowa. But isn't this a bit ironic? Who's doing this? These are the people who support spreading democracy through force, that we take up young men, send them to Iraq. We lose 3,500 men. We have wounded and sick of 50, 60,000. And we are dying to spread democracy. And these are the ones who are promoting that. At the same time, they're denying democracy here. It doesn't make any sense. So this should be a big issue. And quite frankly, the attention that we get and they get from making this point points out how inconsistent, how ridiculous it is. And quite frankly, I think the people are going to rise up on this. It's certainly the people on the internet will not let this go unnoticed. I'm delighted you're interested in the subject. But, you know, the major media right now, they're not particularly interested in this. So we'll have to see what happens. We'll see if we can awaken the people.
Let's go to Josh in Houston, Texas. Josh, you're on with Congressman Ron Paul.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about the presidential candidate forum in Iowa. I was very disappointed that he was excluded. I am from Texas. Ed Failer talked about that only a few from Iowa had called in complaining about that, as if that's the only people that mattered who are interested in politics.
This is the group Iowans for Tax Relief, a kind of watchdog group, and they are inviting six candidates, excluding Ron Paul and a couple of others there.
Correct, and they handed out 17 invitations, and only six or seven accepted. But Ron Paul didn't get one. But if you're going to try to sway the people in Iowa, one way or another, that affects everyone in America, whether they're from Iowa, Texas, California, or New York.
Josh, if he gets 1% or less in the polls, maybe Ron Paul's not relevant to that debate.
Well, I think that it's so far away from the primary, so far away from the elections, that I don't know how accurate those polls are, especially with the internet. A lot of those people are younger. A lot of them have cell phones. They don't have the landlines.
Yeah, we hear it. Josh in Houston, thanks very much for calling. You're near Ron Paul territory down there. Congressman Paul, how about it? Do you think you're going to disappear soon? Are you going to blink out on us in this debate season?
I don't think that's going to happen. For instance, you know, if we're excluded out in Iowa with this forum, who knows? We may end up with a rally a lot bigger than their little forum. So you can't ever tell. Sometimes when they try to do things, it's just like our foreign policy. Sometimes there are unintended consequences. So we might participate in bringing about some of the unintended consequences from their excluding me from the forum.
You have raised a ruckus around 9/11, and you're being quoted or characterized as having said that we sort of brought it on ourselves. There's some kind of hoax here. We're not getting the whole story. What do you think about what happened on 9/11?
Well, I think 9/11 was designed by 15 Saudis and out of the 19, and they were trained from their youth to not agree with the United States and to despise us because we had troops in the Middle East, because we had bases in Saudi Arabia. Ironically, the madrasa schools in Saudi Arabia had been financed in the 1980s by our CIA to drum up this hatred against the Soviets, because that was a tool we were using to fight the communists in Afghanistan in particular. So this is another example of blowback on how we create hatred designed to be directed elsewhere, and now it's being directed at us. At the same time, we were an ally, you know, of Osama bin Laden at that time, and now, of course,
in Afghanistan, against the Soviets.
Right, and now he's our arch enemy. Of course, we were an ally of Saddam Hussein, and we invited and supported Saddam Hussein's and his invasion of Iran, and then we wonder why the Iranians might disapprove of us after having imposed the Shah on them for 25 years, and now we are threatening with a nuclear first strike, and then we wonder why they're annoyed with us. I mean, wouldn't it be more a bigger question is why wouldn't they be annoyed with us with our foreign policy? So I would say that if we don't understand that, we can't combat terrorism. And besides, terrorism is a process. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of terrorists. A terrorist is a tactic. It's sort of like declaring war against criminals. Of course, they are criminals, they're thugs, and they're murderers. But there's different government. Timothy McVeigh was a terrorist, but he wasn't part of the terrorist problem that we're facing now, coming from the radical Muslims. But we have to understand this. And one example I use a lot of time about trying to promote ourselves over the over the world is the example of Vietnam. Just think of our wasted 60,000 lives we lost in Vietnam trying to impose our will on Vietnam. And yet today, they are westernized, they're capitalized, and they're a friend. We're trading partners and we invest. All these things accomplished through peaceful means, taking the advice of the founders that we shouldn't interfere militarily, but we should try to get along with people, talk to them, and trade with them.
And yet they have hit the United States when Rudy Giuliani says, we are at war, we must track them down and crush them. What's going on there? Do you think he's just not thinking or just thinking differently from you?
Well, I think he's actually—I think he's demagoguing the issue for political purposes, and also it served his purpose on the speaking tours to talk like that and capitalize on his position when he was mayor. But to do that, there's a lot of terrorism in Sri Lanka. I mean, is he going to go after the terrorists there? I mean, it doesn't mean anything. You know, when people declare war, they do it for a purpose. And if it's accidental that the war started, they use it as an advantage. Whether it's a war in Iraq, war against terrorism, or war against drugs, this is always used to intimidate the people, frighten the people, and get the people to sacrifice their liberties. Because too many Americans have drifted to the point where, well, at least they're making me safe. We want a Giuliani because he's tough and he's going to make me safe. So what do? They permit warrantless searches. They allow national ID card to come into effect. They give up habeas corpus. They endorse military commissions and get out of the regular court system. They go along with torture. And they endorse the idea of preemptive war just so the terrorists might not ever come because we might be attacked. We are literally giving up everything that we have earned through our revolution and what the founders gave us in our Constitution. So, quite frankly, I think there's very little left in protecting us for our civil liberties in this country because of individuals like Giuliani who will demagogue and use this issue to promote their programs and their authoritarian approach to solving all our problems.
Hello, Rudy. There's Congressman Ron Paul. Let's go to Bob in Aiken, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom and Dr. Paul. Finally, a presidential candidate who makes some sense and seems to be more interested in the welfare of the country as opposed to advancing their own interests.
Bob, do you say that as a Republican, as a Democrat, as a Libertarian, an independent, what?
I used to be a Republican, and now I think we have a one-party system with two branches, and I think that's indicated by what's being done to Dr. Paul out in Iowa.
What do you say? What's your question for Congressman Paul?
Well, first of all, let me just say it's rare that I have the opportunity to talk with an American hero, and that's what I'm doing right now. I also apologize for the uninformed Republican dog pack that greeted him in South Carolina and was cheering Giuliani's vacuous patriotism. My question is, For whom in the Congress, Dr. Paul, do you feel an affinity? That is, any fellow travelers? Frankly, I find none, which is very depressing. And secondly, what will it take to get some focus and conversation going on the disastrous economic policies of this government? Is it going to take a complete collapse?
Ron Paul. Thanks, Bob.
Yes, very, very good. You know, in some ways, I feel no affinity with one particular individual who really looks at the world and the economy and foreign policy as I do. But that's
how about said, Dennis Kucinich? He's the Democrat.
But that said, almost everybody I feel an affinity to. You take a Dennis Kucinich. Very close affinity. Yesterday, he and I were the only ones that voted no on a resolution which we both interpreted as just being war propaganda, getting the country ready to go to war against Iran just like they were doing before Iraq.
But he must be far from you on economics, Dennis Kucinich.
But, yeah, and there were 11 or so that voted present, and they were annoyed too, and there were a bunch who were annoyed, but they could not come to voting something that AIPAC sent out the message, you better vote for this or you're going to be on our list as being unfriendly. So that's how how strongly, even the very, very strong anti-war, anti-Iraq war people in Congress could not do it because of that type of pressure. So, yes, Dennis and I do very well on national sovereignty issues and on foreign policy, but we're very polite in our discussions about, you know, the economy and economics, because even though I'm a free market person and I really don't endorse in principle the welfare state, because I see that as using the same force that is used to try to make people better and make the world better, and I don't think the federal government should use that. But that said, I am also very open to the idea of priorities, which you have to, and you have to live in a practical world. So if people are dependent on the government, has taught to be dependent, if they're elderly or the poor, and they are, their budgets are being jeopardized right now. That's where they're trying to cut. At the same time, they won't touch an embassy in Iraq for $1 billion and 14 military bases in Iraq, which is going to undermine our whole system of defense, and it's going to cost a lot of money. It makes us less safe. So I'm willing to cut a lot of that and really work on a transition program to help people who have become so dependent. And that, to me, is the only way we can solve some of these economic problems.
Congressman Bob in South Carolina is picking up on your economic doomsaying, your warning of collapse. Bob seems to be in that same camp. What do you see going on there, and what, in your view, would be the tonic?
Well, and the gentleman also said, are we waiting for an economic collapse, or can we come to and have some common sense and work this out? I think the odds of the collapse are much greater than us coming to common, you know, common answers, because we'd have to talk the leadership of Republicans and Democrats to change our foreign policy and change our Middle East policy. And I don't see that happening. I think the American people would accept what I'm saying, and they're with us, but the message is very difficult to get out, and I don't know whether the internet can handle it and get the changes made. But we are spending way too much money. And if you look at history, empires end always badly because they run out of money. The Soviet system collapsed because it was a non-functioning system, because socialism doesn't work. Today, we don't have socialism, but we have sort of a mild form of fascism where we have corporatism, where the corporations are on the dole. They are the ones who are making the money off the military-industrial complex. And, of course, banks and big corporations make money because of the monetary system we have. When you have a fiat system, there's a automatic transfer of wealth from the middle class and the poor to the rich.
Fascism? Are you saying we're living in a fascist state?
One that's leaning toward that, because you take our medical care. Nobody's happy with it. I don't like it. And those who want even more government don't like it. But I want less government. But
we have fascist medical care?
This is where the corporations run things. You know, the HMOs, the PPOs, the drug companies, and then they work in collusion and they get the contracts. Why would it be that the drug companies are the biggest lobbyists for the prescription drug program? Is that because they're worrying about getting care to poor people? No, they're worrying about making big bucks.
And here we've got an out-of-the-box Republican. Let's take a call from Alpharetta, Georgia. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
And I'm taking time out of my work day to call to let you know that I appreciate you putting Dr. Paul on. I joined the Marines from Victoria, Texas, back in 1966, and so I have a personal affinity for Dr. Paul and his campaign, and I would just like to point out that if there's anything negative about his campaign, it's the fact that he's bringing too much truth to the world. There's so much factual information that he's hitting us with that Americans need to wake up to. Not only the war, but Congress has shirked its responsibility in declaring war. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and at the time, you know, I thought it was a necessary thing to do, but I've since had my eyes open up. I feel like I just woke up these last 2 years, and I'm seeing, our country is going down the tubes with fiat money. The fact that you know, signing statements override the intent of law passed through Congress. There's virtually no differentiation between the Republicans and the Democrats, and we need to reclaim our liberty. If we don't elect Dr. Paul this election, then the powers that be are just going to continue on, and the America will be subsumed into the North American Union. In fact, part of this legislation, this immigration legislation is passing through right now, is meant to speed up the security and prosperity partnership.
Phil, you're pointing there at NAFTA and immigration reform. We'll look at that. But let me get just, and thank you for your call. But Ron Paul, let me just get you on the record. You don't like the Iraq war. What would you do? We're in there. We're in there heavy right now. What would you do if Phil had his way and put you in the White House?
I'd bring the troops home. I would immediately tell them no more policing the streets. I'd let the Iraqis do it and let them work it out.
What about civil war, meltdown, oil fields of fire, no more petrol supplies and all the rest?
They would have to deal with it.
What about us?
We just leave. We've had too many of our people killed, and we've killed too many of them. Our policies are flawed, like the gentleman mentioned. We went there; it wasn't even a declaration of war. We went in there because there were weapons of mass destruction, and we went in there to enforce UN resolutions against Saddam Hussein. Both those things don't exist in legal technical terms. The authority no longer exists.
But so in a globalized world, there we're in up to our neck, and oil fields are right next door. But even more generally, can the U.S. just withdraw from the world? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, almost the opposite. Mm. Withdrawing our troops is a lot different. We are not withdrawn from Vietnam. I mean, we're more involved than ever.
Vietnamese president's coming here.
And they're more westernized than ever. I think we should remove all the sanctions from the Iranians and start trading with them and let them develop peaceful nuclear power, which is they have a right under the NPT to do. And we should have more respect for international law. So I think that would be a step in the right direction. But for us to bully everybody and to say that, well, it's a flawed policy. Yes, we lost a lot of men. But the longer we stay, the more chaotic. Well, that's just send more men. And, you know, since the surge, we're losing more men, not less. So it's to me, it's sort of, I look at it like I do in medicine. If I were to make a mistake and make the wrong diagnosis and give the wrong treatment, the patient got sicker, and I didn't change the diagnosis and change the treatment, then it would be malpractice. I would kill the patient.
Congressman, let's go to Panama City, Florida. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Joanne. I'm an 80-year-old retired school teacher and a lifelong Democrat who would love to see Ron Paul really, really make progress.
Are you sure he wants to blow up the Department of Education? He's anti-abortion?
No. You come to my first question, and that is, so much emphasis has been put on his attitude toward foreign policy, mm-hmm. and I agree so wholeheartedly that my first question is, what else does he believe in? Obviously, I'm going to have to start doing some research. But it's important for me to say to other Democrats that right now the greatest danger to our nation is its imperialistic attitude toward the entire world.
But if you see the rest of his platform, it may singe your eyebrows a little bit, Joanne. Hang on, and we'll look at it with him. Let me get one more call first from Boston. Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
All right, what do you think?
Basically, that woman just stole my thunder. Unfortunately, I wanted to say that as a rational man, I agree with his policy towards the war, but, you know, there are a lot of other things that a president needs to deal with. And as a Democrat, you know, I guess we are sort of big government, and, you know, to do away with the Department of Energy and the Department of Education and whatnot, my fear would be, well, who's going to take, you know, I want to know what his opinion is as to who's going to take over those responsibilities. You know, the bureaucracy is rather huge and kind of cumbersome, but it does serve a purpose. And without those, who's going to fill that void?
Sean and Joanne, we'll pick those up. Congressman, what about it? You say no Department of Education, no Department of Homeland Security, no Department of Energy, no to abortion, no to gun control, no to immigration reform. You are Dr. No.
Well, I'm Dr. Yes for the Constitution. I'm Dr. Yes for liberty. So I can defend each one of those. I can't go through all five of those here in a couple minutes. But I approach all those positions through the Constitution because it's the only oath I take. So I see no place in the Constitution for the Department of Education. I also see that it's not doing a very good job. The Department of Education now is not a friend of the teachers. Currently, I have a lot of young teachers who are very, very annoyed with no child left behind, national testing, testing of teachers, and the whole interference and the dictation toward books. So the teachers are turning against federal control of education. They thought it was a way to get more money and higher salaries, but it was meant to be local. Whether it's the abortion issue, yes, I'm pro-life. I'm an OB doctor, and I cannot stand the idea that somebody would pay me to kill a baby that's 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 pounds, and that's legal. And yet, if the baby is born and you kill the baby, you are charged with murder. But once again, I'm not looking for a federal police force. That's a state function. It's a difficult problem, and it should be worked out elsewhere. And that's the magnificence of the Constitution, is the more difficult the problem, the less government you should have, the less federal government you should have, and it should be worked out locally.
But in the last decade, we seem to be facing a lot of areas in which government cutbacks leave us wondering how the society is going to work. Katrina, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans seemed like Exhibit A. We had a huge disaster, and the government seemed unable to respond even when it should, even when it seemed very apparently needed. What's the lesson there to you?
The message is loud and clear that that's my point. The more money you give them, the more bureaucracy you have, and the less efficient they are. It is a beautiful point. What did they do? They went out and they said, oh, they need homes. Well, we'll buy 500 trailers. But they never got to the people. And yet, if you look back before we had FEMA and all this big government, in 1900, we had our worst hurricane, and Galveston was wiped off the map. And they rebuilt without the federal government. They built a seawall that still exists. You have more money and less bureaucracy if you approach it locally. You don't have less money. And what do? And you have to mix this in with what's happening in Iraq. When you need a National Guard to help preserve order in a particular state, we find out they're in Iraq and that we don't have the money. And it is true that some of these things domestically, and I mentioned earlier in the show that I would work out transitions to help people, even though in theory we might not need them or should have them and there are better ways. That's not my attack. My attack really is to make the point about liberty and the Constitution and stop the war, tide people over if they're in need.
Take another big challenge. Challenge, though, global warming. It looks like a challenge that's going to require a concerted effort to solve. You say no. You say solve it all through property rights. What do you mean by that?
Well, the whole thing is if you look at it under property rights, no person ever has the authority to violate a neighbor's property, whether it's air or water. It is the countries that had the least respect for property rights, such in the Soviet system, they had the most pollution. And so more government doesn't help. But today, in this what I describe as corporatism or fascist-leaning system, we now have a bill going through Congress where you'll be required to subsidize coal liquefaction. And, you know, coal is probably not the best source of energy. At the same time, the government gets in the way of hindering the cleanest source of fuel, and that's nuclear. We have oil. Right now, we have a government that is spending our lives of young people and all this money to go over there and protect our oil, pushing oil prices up. In order to run the Pentagon, we use 14 million gallons of gas and oil every single day.
You really think simply a free market approach then would solve the global warming issue, with each company going after its own interests without
there's still some debate going on. Obviously, man does some polluting, but there are some statistics that might challenge that we should be lying around and feeling guilty. Yes, so we have a responsibility.
You say there is no global warming? No human-caused global warming?
No, I say there is, but the degree is still up for debate. What we do know is if you are contributing, you should do something about it. But some of the most outspoken people that we hear, maybe in Hollywood, aren't necessarily the ones who are conserving, you know. But I think it's too often a collusion with government and big business that produces so much of the pollution, just like I was mentioning, how much oil the Pentagon, we burn more oil per day than the whole country of Sweden just in our Pentagon. So if you wanted to cut something back, why don't we deal with that? But what I don't advocate is that the United States have the responsibility to march in on China and claim that we have the authority to stop China from polluting because they're polluting more than we are. And I just think that we have to have a reasoned approach to that. But the whole
I think
idea
not
that
yet, but maybe soon they'll outstrip us on that front. Congressman, we have so many people who want to speak with you. If you'll permit me, I'd like to go to a couple more calls here.
Okay.
Providence, Rhode Island. Bob, you're on with Ron Paul.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Dr. Paul, the foremost concern for me as an American, I've always been an independent, concerns the basic ideological shift from Cold War deterrence, containment, to, you know, what the Project for the New American Century, with Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, signatories to that, have shifted to what is now preemptive military action against anyone we want, with the sole purpose of spreading democracy. My great concern is that with all these issues in place, the War Powers Act of 06, what's going to happen with Iran? I know that Dick Cheney's been sitting back. My great fear is that he's going to gain control of the situation again, and we're going to find ourselves attacking Iran.
Bob, let us pick it up. Ron Paul, where do you see that headed?
Well, I'll tell you, he really hit a spot with me on that, because they asked a question in the last debate, what was the greatest moral problem that we're facing? And, of course, I used that very example, and I said it was preemptive war, the whole idea that mm-hmm. we now start wars, even though in the past we were engaged way too much than we should, but at least we had a pretty strong argument. We went to rescue people and help people and defend liberty. But now it's just out of the clear blue, attacking countries that are incapable of even defending themselves, let alone a threat to us. And he's absolutely right to be concerned about Iran. That resolution that we voted on yesterday was just more of the war propaganda. We're conditioning the people to go after Iran, and just like they did before Iraq. And it may be a distraction from Iraq, and they're going to get us all worked up. What I am just afraid of is what's going to happen is there is going to be an accident, whether it's contrived or a true accident. A lot of Americans are going to be killed. It could be done by Osama bin Laden. It'll be blamed on the Iranians, and the American people are going to be ready to go to war. They'll probably accept the draft, and they'll be drafting young women too. If we don't change this trend, he's absolutely right to make this point that this moral challenge that we have about accepting preemptive war, containment has worked before. We stood down the Soviets with 40,000 nuclear weapons. I was called to duty in 1963 and stayed in the Air Force for 5 years and lived through the Cold War, and we didn't have to fight them. But here we go after people and threaten them with nuclear weapons, and they don't even have a nuclear weapon. I mean, when are we going to wake up?
Jan's calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air with Congressman Ron Paul.
Well, thank you for having my call. And first of all, I just have to say, I hope everyone in the country hears this. I'm a registered Democrat. I looked at both primaries. I heard Ron Paul, and I was like, this guy makes more sense than anyone I know of. I'm calling because of Unity 08. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's an online presidential primary. It's actually the idea is a group of us are trying to transcend the Democrat and Republican politics and get a ticket that has both a Democrat and a Republican on it. And delegates can vote online. And I'm wondering if Ron Paul, should he be elected in this, would he be willing to serve as like a co-president with a Democrat, maybe with Dennis Kucinich?
Ron Paul, do you fit with a Democrat, any Democrat?
Well, I'm not thinking along those lines. I have enough on my plate right now. But like I said earlier, Dennis and I get along real well, and we actually can discuss economic issues, although we have disagreements. And I back off, from saying we have to close down everything overnight. There's a lot of transition, a lot of ways you can come together if we can get this budget under control and get the war ended.
But you've been so critical of the GOP. Are you less critical of the Democrats?
No, not really. I criticize policy, and I think the policies are designed by both parties. So yes, I'm probably as critical of both, because policies never change. Big government rolls along. They have no concern about the Constitution. They both go to war without declaration. They both have endorsed preemptive war. They don't care about deficits. They don't care about, well, if you come up short money, just print the money, which is so damaging to the poor people. And people have to understand the monetary issue. If they care about the poor and they care about unemployment and if they care about inflation, they have to look at the Federal Reserve System and this absurdity that if you need money, you print it. I mean, that's called counterfeit if you do it privately. And when government does it, they call it good economic policy.
Let's go to, if we can, Baber City, North Carolina. We've got a truck driver calling in right there, LJ. LJ, are you there, my friend?
Yes. How you doing?
Good. What do you know? What do you ask?
Well, I'm asking real quick is why would he want to get rid of a Department of Education? You know, that's my point. And another point is the welfare system. It's not like it used to be. It's where it's supposed to be at now. It was meant to be temporary. And if you eliminate it all together, I mean, you know, like the Bible says, the poor will always be with us. I mean, you can't make everybody rich.
But do you think we need the welfare, some welfare system, LJ, or not?
Well, I think we need it, you know, to help people get back on their feet, yes. But not just to eliminate it, that's what I'm saying.
Ron Paul, what do you say? LJ sounds concerned about your readiness to get the knife out on both of these.
Well, and he also makes the point temporary. He's arguing the case of a very, very conservative approach to it, which is my argument right now for a transition. That certainly would be the approach. The problem is, though, that young people who are going to work now, into the workforce now, are going to be obligated to come up with $70 trillion worth of wealth to subsidize those who are in retirement years and for their medical care, and we don't have the money. So it's coming to an end. So even if you don't accept my ideas of the limitation of government power, it will be limited, and something's going to happen. It'll happen like what happened with the Soviets. The system collapses, and like I said earlier, the empires of previous great countries and great nations always ends because they can't afford it and they spread themselves too thin, and that's going to happen, and I'm trying to avoid that. But you know, I make the point that that doesn't mean that you strike out and go after the weakest. I'm striking out against war, the military-industrial complex, the corporatism that exists, a money system that hurts the poor, and a tax system that is abusive to our liberties. I mean, this is a practical approach, but it's philosophic as well. It's a vote for the Constitution. It's a vote for liberty. And it's a vote to get the government out of our bedrooms, out of our wallets, off our backs, and out of the foreign countries.
Congressman, the odds of you winning the GOP nomination appear essentially nil. So what would bring you satisfaction at the end of this process if it doesn't turn out to be that nomination?
Well, we don't know. There were other candidates that had exactly the same percentage that I have at this time.
Anything could happen, but okay,
yeah.
Okay. But shy of that, what would bring you satisfaction?
Well, what satisfies me is if I'm well-informed and I study well and that I can formulate the opinions, that I can defend liberty properly, and I make progress. Quite frankly, I'm pretty critical of myself and my ability to do this, but I have no doubts whatsoever how valuable the cause of liberty is and what we were granted through our Constitution and our traditions. It was the best ever, and we're losing it. If one can say that I've contributed to slowing it up or reversing the trend, I think there's a new paradigm being formed. I think this younger generation have had it. They know what they're getting. They don't like the war, and they don't like the debt, and they don't like their obligation. So who knows what might come of this? But I tend to be an optimist long term. I think our traditions have been great, except right now, I think we're facing some serious problems. If we don't change them, these problems are going to get much, much worse. And to have a collision economically is much worse than dealing with the problems as I suggest.
Republican Congressman Ron Paul, contender for the Republican Party presidential nomination, right there at the edge of the stage, but speaking up very loud. Congressman Paul, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.